Welcome to Rethinking Wellness, a podcast and Substack newsletter that offers critical thinking and compassionate skepticism about wellness and diet culture and reflections on how to find true well-being. I'm your host, Christy Harrison. I'm a health journalist, a registered dietitian specializing in disordered eating, and the author of three books, including Anti-Diet, The Emotional Eating, Chronic Dieting, Binge Eating, and Body Image Workbook, and The Wellness Trap, which was the inspiration for this podcast. If you like what you hear, become a paid subscriber to get all our content at rethinkingwellness.substack.com. Hey there. Welcome to this episode of Rethinking Wellness. Today, I'm talking about how to make sure a quote-unquote healthy dietary change doesn't spiral into disordered eating, and how to know your desire to change your eating is driven by health and not diet culture in the first place. The first part of this piece is available for everyone, and paid subscribers can hear the whole thing. You can upgrade to paid at rethinkingwellness.substack.com. Paid subscribers also get a bunch of other perks like extended interviews with our guests, monthly office hours with me, commenting privileges and a place to connect with other listeners, subscriber-only Q&As and essays like this one, and lots more. Just go to rethinkingwellness.substack.com to sign up or click the link in the show notes. And if you're already a paid subscriber, I'm so grateful for your support, which allows me to keep doing this work. And now on to this week's essay. My first postpartum experience was no walk in the park, but it was nothing compared to the second. The first time around, after a protracted labor and unplanned C-section, I developed ileus, a painful condition where the digestive system basically shuts down. With the second delivery, I managed to avoid that fate, but a few hours after giving birth, I felt that something just wasn't right. I started having trouble breathing, which got worse anytime I tried to lie down, even at a 45-degree angle in the hospital bed, and made sleep virtually impossible. My body also swelled beyond recognition. I knew some swelling or edema was normal after pregnancy, but this was next level. At one point, my nurse called in a trainee to look at my feet, which had filled up like water balloons. Another nurse mused that she hadn't seen swelling like this since her clinical rotations. At first, it seemed like I might have a heart condition, though I saw several different cardiologists who couldn't agree on what it was or whether it was anything at all. My echocardiogram made it look like I had a mild case of postpartum cardiomyopathy, commonly known as congestive heart failure, which doesn't necessarily mean the heart is failing in the immediate get-your-affairs-in-order sense, just that it's not pumping oxygenated blood as effectively as it should. But the most senior cardiologist said pretty much any postpartum mom would have an echocardiogram that looked like mine. Most just don't get echocardiograms. Then, the night before I was due to be discharged from the hospital, my normally low blood pressure spiked, and I was diagnosed with postpartum preeclampsia. This was one thing the doctors all agreed on, and there was a whole protocol to treat it, for which I am incredibly grateful. Left untreated, preeclampsia may progress to seizures and even death, but thankfully that's become very rare with the modern medicine I'm lucky to have access to. Another thing the hospital cardiologists all agreed on was that I should keep my sodium intake very low. One of them even said I should try to be on a zero-sodium diet, which I corrected, pointing out that it was impossible to have zero sodium in the diet, not to mention ill-advised to try. I should point out here that all of this happened at a very good hospital, often ranked number one in my state. Even with the best possible care, medicine is often more art than science, especially in a hospital setting where high-stakes decisions have to be made incredibly quickly and physicians have to rely primarily on clinical intuition. I felt a bit like I was in an episode of The Pitt. Normally, in a situation like this, I would go to PubMed and try to do at least a quick scan of the science. It's conventional wisdom that people with high blood pressure should try to dramatically limit their sodium intake, but I knew from my work as a dietitian that the reality is much more nuanced. Even among researchers who agree that sodium should be restricted for high blood pressure, the level of sodium restriction is a point of contention as well. Since I specialize in disordered eating, I also knew that anyone with an eating disorder history, such as myself, shouldn't be advised to limit their diet without a very strong medical reason, and that, unfortunately, most doctors don't even consider disordered eating as a possible contraindication for dietary changes. In fact, this is one of the reasons I started looking deeply into nutrition science more than a decade ago. I wanted to make sure my clients were making any dietary changes for rock-solid medical reasons, to help ensure that disordered eating wasn't a driving force. I wanted to know that they weren't restricting their eating based on shaky science, which could do more harm than good by potentially exacerbating disordered eating while offering no real improvements in health. I wanted to make sure the benefits of any change in eating truly outweighed the risk. And that's why I still do these deep dives here at Rethinking Wellness. I want to help you understand when a diet or other wellness trend has a real basis in science, when it's experimental and based only on early stage or observational research, or when it's just pure nonsense, so that you can weigh the risks and benefits to make the best possible decisions for your own well-being. And yet, I didn't do any of that research when I was told to restrict sodium for my postpartum issues. I had no bandwidth to do my usual deep dives. I barely even had the energy to look at consumer-facing websites that I know are problematic in many ways. I all but shut off the part of my brain that's automatically skeptical of any diet and just did what my doctors told me to do because I was scared. I've lived with multiple chronic conditions for years, but never had any cardiovascular problems, and it all just seemed so serious. It was only much later, as I was working on this piece, that I actually took a look at the data and found that it doesn't support sodium restriction either to prevent preeclampsia or to lower cardiovascular risk after having preeclampsia, though more and larger studies are needed. Even among heart failure patients, which I turned out not to be, sodium restriction doesn't seem to reduce the risk of death or hospitalization, and stringent sodium restrictions may even carry their own risks. Though the mechanism makes theoretical sense, you know, salt causes water retention, so cut salt for anyone retaining water, the reality plays out differently. So I basically went on a diet, quote unquote, for my health that didn't have good evidence to support it, but I didn't fall back into disordered eating. The sodium restriction wasn't strictly medically necessary, and yet it didn't shake my recovery. This experience showed me that having a good scientific basis for any health-related eating changes isn't necessarily the key to maintaining strong recovery in all cases, though I do still think it's important as a general principle. So what is that key? What do you need to do or not do to make sure a quote-unquote healthy dietary change doesn't spiral into disordered eating? And how do you know your desire to change your eating is driven by health and not by diet culture? Based on both my personal and professional experience, I think there are six crucial things to consider. You've been listening to a free preview of this episode. To hear the rest and get tons more great bonus content, upgrade to paid by going to rethinkingwellness.substack.com.